for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The English philosopher Francis Bacon once said, "Dreams and predictions ought to serve but for winter talk by the fireside." Here at National Geographic Live, we might not have a fireplace, but we do have a live audience and three noted prognosticators who are going to offer their thoughts on next year's presidential election, foreign affairs, and political possibilities we haven't even dreamed of. Joining me, Tom Mann, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Charlie Cook, editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report, and Norman Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Do join us as we go on with political, economic, and foreign affairs discussions here at National Geographic. Join us on 1-800-433-8850 or send us your emails to drshow@wamu.org. And good morning to all of you for your debut appearance here at National Geographic Live.
Good morning, Diane.
Nice to have you here. Charlie Cook, how important do you think the capture of Saddam Hussein is to the re-election of President Bush?
Well, there's no question that it's provided him a huge boost in the polls. Whether it's one that just lasts weeks or a month or two or is somewhat more resilient, I don't know. I tend to think it's probably going to be a boost of a month or 6 weeks. But I think probably more importantly is it throws Howard Dean sort of a very, very fast curveball at a very inopportune time.
We're
4 weeks away from Iowa, and it sort of throws him off his message about the war. I mean, the sort of the centerpiece of Dean's candidacy is his opposition to the war, and for at least a brief period of time, you know, there's a perception that the war is doing a lot better, and so it kind of throws him off his stride at a point when he was, you know, almost nailing down the nomination. So I think the immediate impact, the real impact, I think is more on Dean, perhaps, than the long-term interest of the president.
Tom Mann.
I think that's probably right, although I must say that Dean's response, which has elicited a lot of controversy in Washington and from his Democratic opponents for the presidential nomination, seemingly has strengthened his hand in the nomination battle. There's no signs that any of his supporters were at all distressed by his observation
which was
that Saddam's capture per se did not make us any safer.
Make America any safer.
And in a literal sense, he's quite correct. Whether Saddam is in a spider hole or in U.S. custody doesn't matter much, unless it has an impact on the insurgency, unless this begins to take some of the passion and fire out of those opposing the U.S. But as far as the nomination is concerned, I think what we're seeing is Howard Dean sticking with his opposition to the war and now accusing his adversaries of jumping back and forth on the war depending on what's popular in the polls at the moment.
Norm Ornstein.
You know, certainly in the short run, let me turn to Bush for a minute. This is good news for Bush generally. If we had not captured Saddam all the way through the next year, it would have been an enormous embarrassment. At the same time, this may bring, and I stress the word may, a lot of positive repercussions in a variety of ways. We've speculated that a lot of Iraqis would not cooperate with us because they feared, and I think legitimately, that we would not stay the course, that we would tire of the casualties and the attrition and pull
and
out.
And that Hussein might come back.
As long as he happened to be out there alive, he might come back. And
right.
If he came back, he would make his last regime look like a picnic by comparison with the havoc he would wreak with those who had cooperated. So maybe this will create more cooperation. Maybe it will lead us to weapons. Perhaps it will bring about a better opportunity for us to solidify ourselves in Iraq. At the same time, there may be repercussions around the region. This has to make Assad in Syria nervous. It has to make the mullahs in Iran a little bit nervous. It may help to loosen the ice in the Middle East. But having said all of that, if 3 months from now, 4 months from now, 5 months from now, we're still getting 2, 3, 4, 8, 10, 12 casualties every single day, and there's some reason to believe that the troubles in Iraq have not been orchestrated by Saddam. They're out there independently being conducted and with a lot of help from al-Qaeda now. Saddam's capture is going to fade completely from the scene, and the problems with Iraq, the sense that we're back on our heels, will return.
What about the question of weapons of mass destruction? If they are not found in 2004, even though Saddam Hussein is in our custody, what impact might that have on the 2004 election, Charlie Cook?
I think when this thing becomes a two-way race, when Democrats come up with a nominee and when you know, all these various groups together, whether it's the Democratic campaign itself, the Democratic National Committee, and all these 527, these other groups that are going to be going in doing advertising, I think things are going to put the focus is going to be much more clear that we'll see, you know, statements made last winter and spring about the connection to 9/11, statements about WMD, all these things and sort of the evolution of the justification for the war. I think it's going to be more crystallized, and I think it's going to make things much touchier. I think the fact that you have nine candidates and there's sort of rabble out there, the message hasn't been focused, but when it is, I think it's going to be a lot sharper and tougher for the president.
And, Tom, the independent commission investigating 9/11, that report is due out in May of 2004. How might that had an impact on the 2004 election?
Well, we just had an unintended preview of that report from the chairman, former governor of New Jersey,
Tom Kaine,
indicating that he thought 9/11 was preventable, that there were officials in the government who were in a position acting on information that was clearly available to them to take steps to preempt that attack. Now, that isn't pointing a finger at George Bush or high-ranking members of his administration, but what it's going to do is return us as a country to thinking about how well the government prepared for threats that were well known for many years. We've been talking about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda for many years.
And this, of course, takes us back to Howard Dean's comment on this program where he said there are theories out there that the Bush administration did have warnings of 9/11 before it occurred. You know, the conservative columnists have just taken this and said, well, you know, he's floating around in the ether somewhere with these comments, but perhaps not.
It doesn't take a conspiracy theory to point out that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice's statement that we never had any idea that terrorists would use civilian aircraft as weapons of terrorism. That was simply wrong. That was something we knew about for not months, but years.
How did we know about that?
There had been previous attempts to do this. There were reports made available by the intelligence community that two officials, there were reports of training of terrorists in civilian flight and the rest. So that was, at the very least, a mistaken statement that will almost reemerge, certain to reemerge in the public debate.
Norm.
You know, I think that it's quite possible that the Achilles heel of the Bush administration will not be Iraq, but will be Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is struggling to get up to par. Another commission, government commission, has said that our preparations in this area are close to pathetic. If this report comes out, and Governor Kaine is basically going to try and release everything in a report for any American who wants to see it, and this commission of 10 people is an extraordinarily impressive group of people. It's Tom Kaine, it's Lee Hamilton, it's people of enormous integrity.
And why has the White House continued to refuse to release its own documents to that commission?
Well, there's some reason for any White House to want to protect information that the president himself gets. But in this case, at least the rumor that has been out there is that somewhere in the president's briefings in the days and weeks leading up to 9/11, there was a very explicit warning about potential use of aircraft in this case. Now, we don't know that. We do know that the members of the 9/11 Commission did work out an arrangement with the White House where the chairs at least got to see this information, and others had some access to it. We'll find out, I think, everything that happened. Now, more than likely, there's going to be blame to cast going back a long ways here. But the fact is the administration was in office for 8 months leading up to this, and some of that fallout may be there. And if there's another attack somewhere, depending on the timing of it, that could end up being a problem for them. Let me just raise one issue, getting back to the question of weapons of mass destruction and the impact of Saddam. We should keep in mind there will be a trial here. This is going to get an awful lot of attention. Now, we were speculating the other day about what would happen if there's the Michael Jackson trial and the Saddam trial are on at the same time. And I said, well, the cable networks will, you know, we'll put on Michael Jackson.
I cannot believe you raised his name.
Some things are really important.
Yeah, really.
Well, we know where cable television will be, and it will be with Johnny Cochran and Michael Jackson.
But not public radio.
Not public radio, I promise you.
But you get that trial coming up, and, you know, maybe coincidentally it'll come to its peak in the fall of 2004. And we find out all of the atrocities in great detail that the Saddam regime committed, mass graves, gassing his own people and so on. That will likely take a situation now whereby a 2-to-1 margin Americans support our being in Iraq, and it will put the weapons of mass destruction issue very much off to
all
the
right,
side.
All right, but that is a question, isn't it? How soon Saddam will come to trial,
yeah.
How that agreement is going to be reached as to where he's going to be put on trial, who will be involved in that. Is it likely to go to Iraq with international advisors, Tom?
Almost certainly. The U.S. will insist on that. And I think the plan is to allow the trial to go forward as soon after authority is transferred to the Iraqis,
and
which is now planned for July, I believe, of next year. So look for the trial in September, October, in the full rush of the general election campaign.
Tom Mann, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Charlie Cook is editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. And Norman Ornstein is arrested. And for those of you who've just joined us, we're at National Geographic Live with a political, international, foreign affairs outlook for 2004. Our guests here in the studio, Charlie Cook. He's editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report and a columnist for the National Journal. Tom Mann is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm sure he has other titles as well. Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And, of course, we do have a wonderful live audience here. You are welcome to go to the microphones with your own questions or comments. We'll open the phones in just a moment, 1-800-433-8850, and we'll take your phone calls on, your emails to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Gil. who says, I understand some groups of gay Republicans are considering switching parties after President Bush's endorsement of a marriage amendment last week on ABC. Let's talk about that so-called marriage amendment and President Bush's endorsement. Number one, do you believe that a so-called marriage amendment will come up in the next term of Congress? Do you believe it'll pass? And how do you believe it will affect Republicans at the polls in 2002, Charlie?
I'm conflicted here. On one hand, I think when you have a big election, you know, election with about war, about economy, that tends to crowd out or take all the oxygen out of the room, so that social and cultural issues tend to kind of go down in importance. And I think that's a strong tendency. On the other hand, we're in an era where the two parties' bases are so intensified, and getting your base vote out is so important that an issue like this for Republicans is certainly very attractive to kind of whip up the base, even if among swing voters in the middle, or at least heterosexual swing voters in the middle, you know, it's probably they have an opinion, but it's probably not anything that they would actually vote on. But I don't see this as a dominant issue in the election. I really don't.
Tom.
I fearlessly predict that a constitutional amendment is not voted upon in the coming year, because I think the president will push to keep it off the agenda.
Why?
You could see in his statement that he was trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, he said if necessary, I would support a constitutional amendment. He said he also believed the states ought to determine whether they want to provide the opportunity for civil unions for gays. Now, that angered his party's base, while sort of moderate Republicans were unhappy with his reference to the constitutional amendment. A large majority of Americans now are uneasy about gay marriages, but the view that we should put in our Constitution the fact that marriages are available only to people of opposite genders is something a majority of Americans, roughly equal numbers, are uncomfortable
with. All right. We have a question here in the studio. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. My name is Seth. I'm from D.C., came from Mount Pleasant. I have a question about the general state of the Democratic Party right now. We heard last hour from the guests some discussion about the fact that many of the so-called insider Democratic candidates have gone on record this past week saying that Howard Dean is not qualified. There were also some rather nasty ads taken out which use Osama bin Laden's face as a way to suggest that Howard Dean's not qualified, and those ostensibly came from other Democrats. Meanwhile, when Al Gore got behind Howard Dean, there was a lot of criticism from him within the party. And then something that's not been talked about a lot is the fact that there are also congressional elections coming up, and there are a number of prominent Democrats from the South that are not going to be running. So a year from now, obviously it has a lot to do with what happens in the presidential election, but what does the Democratic Party look like a year from now?
Interesting question. Tom Mann or Norm Hornstein?
Well, let's go back for a second to the gay marriage issue in the broader context. I do believe that this is an election in which the main focus is going to be energizing the two parties' bases, and with less focus on those voters in the middle. Although what the president's going to try to do, and I think what both parties are going to try to do, is keep that base energizing on issues like this a little bit below their level, and let it be carried out by activists and operatives. That'll be particularly true if Howard Dean is the party's nominee. He is such an overwhelming front runner right now that it's not surprising that all these other candidates are taking off after him, or most of these other candidates, actually not all of them. There are a couple of candidates out there now who would be very happy if Howard Dean swept through Iowa and New Hampshire. They're the ones who are not running in Iowa and New Hampshire, so that then you'll have a Dean and an anti-Dean, and it'll be one of them. The last thing that they want is for somebody to knock off Howard Dean early on. The level of rhetoric is increasing. It's ratcheting up. It's getting very, very nasty. That's in part because Dean is doing so well and is so far ahead.
But I think the basic question, Norm, is does the Democratic Party hold together?
Well, and you know, first, there are certainly members of the establishment of the Democratic Party who are nervous that Howard Dean would have weaknesses as a candidate. The fundamental reality is when you're running against an incumbent president, it's a referendum on the incumbent, and it's his performance that's going to matter far more than who that Democrat is. If Dean wins this nomination early, he's got ample time to heal the wounds and to begin to move towards the middle. If he can show the discipline that he's shown now in his reaction to these other candidates, and what we've seen in the past is that even when Democrats have been swept in presidential contests, like Walter Mondale in 1984 or George McGovern in 1972, it's had no impact on Senate races.
Charlie.
If you took a national poll today, it would and ask, you know, do you consider yourself a Democrat or Republican? You know, basically 44, and you kind of push the leaners each way, 44%, give or take 2%, would be Democrat, 44%, give or take 2%, would be Republicans. More likely than not, where Democrats have been up more like a point or so, although the last poll I saw, Republicans were up by a point. But basically, even at the grassroots level, it's pretty evenly divided. Now, in the U.S. Senate, Democrats have real problems because of the nature of the Senate. States, each state has two, and because of the Rocky Mountain states and increasingly the South, Republicans are on the verge of cementing a very, very durable Senate majority, I think, over the next few years. And these five open states in the South, open seats in the South, although I don't think Republicans are going to win all of them, you know, they have some real opportunities there. The House is locked into a closer range, and while I think it's unlikely that Democrats are going to get a majority in the House back in the next couple of elections due to redistricting, but it's in a fairly narrow band where I don't think you'll see either party dominating in the House for a while.
Diane, the differences among Democrats now in the presidential race are more style than substance. If you really look at their broad foreign policy, there's wide agreement. I think what you're seeing is the result of the outsider insurgent candidate coming out of nowhere and catapulting to the front, upsetting a lot of Washington establishment
sounds
types.
Just as, like Jimmy Carter.
Indeed. But Howard Dean is not an extreme candidate in his views, domestic or international. And my own view is if he wraps up this nomination by early February, which is possible, the party is likely to come together and begin waging a pretty unified general election campaign.
All right, let's go to Ann in Akron, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I have two questions. First, several of the candidates have hunting records, and that would include Wesley Clark, Dick Cheney, who killed 81 cage-raised birds last weekend, and John Kerry. Is there a relationship between the ability to slaughter animals and the ability to do violence to human beings? And secondly, is a jet pilot who bombs pregnant women a partial birth abortionist?
Let's take a look at that question of hunting, because it did come out last week with a report of Vice President Cheney shooting 80, I think, caged birds that were released. In other words, it was not your sort of traditional overnight hunt. Do you want to comment, Charlie?
Well, I think on the broader issue, if you go back to, say, 1994, the number one reason why union members voted more Republican than they had any time in modern history was the gun issue. And while the gun issue, the broader gun issue, it's like a really sharp sword with very sharp edges on both sides, where there's no question about it, the gun issue has hurt Republicans with women in general, with soccer moms in certain parts of the country, other demographic groups. But that gun issue has hurt Democrats just as much in the South, in the border South, in rural small town America, and with union members. And it's become an incredibly divisive issue that cuts against and also benefits both parties. Now, Democrats the last couple of years have have decided just to shut up on the issue, that they're doing very well with women voters, very well with suburban women voters in general, and by just not talking about it, maybe they wouldn't aggravate their situation in among union members, male union members, and in certain parts of the country. But it's an issue that, in a lot of ways, both parties would almost like to go away.
You think it will?
No.
It's not going to go
away. It's not going to go away, but the thing about it is, the kinds of voters that Democrats pull in by talking about gun control are also the same voters that you pull in, generally speaking, talking about abortion and talking about the environment. There are other issues that you can get the same people with without talking so much about guns.
And here's an email specifically for you, Charlie. I think we can all readily see how Saddam's capture puts Dean off his mark. But does it help any of the other Democrats in particular?
I don't think it helps any specific other Democrat as much as, because it throws Dean off his stride, it just presents an opportunity. Now, Dick Gephardt has the soonest opportunity simply because in Iowa, he and Dean are neck and neck. And so he hits the first shot at him, but more, it just sort of slows down. And the thing is, I don't think this has actually hurt Dean with the people that were already with him, but his elasticity, his ability to kind of continue his growth, may be slowed down during this period of time. But, if Dean wins Iowa, I think he's probably got a 90% shot of the nomination. But if Dean loses Iowa to Gephardt, I suspect it drops down to about 60. And suddenly, February 3rd, those South Carolina, Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Missouri, North Dakota, that becomes a really big day.
At 25 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And a question here in the audience. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Robert Benjamin. I'm visiting from Baltimore. And like a lot of American people, I'm very concerned about the current employment situation. And I'm in the IT industry, and I have I'm searching for technical writing work. And unfortunately, I found that a lot of the IT jobs, like the manufacturing industry, have gone offshore. And so a lot of people in software development are finding it very, very difficult to find work. And I also have a Stanford degree, and there are lots of people out there who have, wonderful degrees from good schools, and they're out there working at Walmart and taking jobs because they have to. And not only that, I have another strike against me that I've got a mental illness. So I sort of feel like, I've been out of work for 2 months, which... In the scheme of things, is not that bad, considering some people have been out of work for like a year and a half.
I understand. I really want to express my sadness at your finding yourself out of work at this time of the year, most especially those IT jobs, like manufacturing jobs, just going out of here.
Diane, it's such an important statement because it makes us realize all this talk about the surge in the gross domestic product in the third quarter and how everything is turning around, the stock market is going up. I mean, the reality is that some of our unemployment problems is cyclical, and there will be some jobs added and some people will be finding work, but much of it is structural. And now concerns about employment, both finding jobs and holding on to good jobs, is growing among those with good educations, with white-collar jobs, with skills in information technology and the rest. So I think it underscores the point that the economy remains front and center as a concern for many Americans, and it certainly will be for this coming campaign?
Charlie.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think right now, you know, in the third quarter, I think the economy was on sort of a sugar high because of so much stimulus. But at the same time, when you look underneath, boy, there's just some real problems. And I think our guest is a great example of this because, you know, when people who worked in factories making pencils were losing their jobs, then you could easily say, well, you know, gosh, maybe in this country, in a high-wage country, a highly developed country, maybe we shouldn't be making pencils. And so we told people, go out and get knowledge-based jobs, get jobs that are durable, that can last you a whole career. And the problem now is, even outside of the manufacturing sector, is that we're now losing those and losing those by the boatload. And you know, if the answer were protectionism, then this would be easy. I mean, everybody knows how to do that. But if the answer is not protectionism, I don't know what the heck
is
it is.
Norm?
Charlie says we have a Krispy Kreme economy up on a sugar high now. I actually think keep your eye on the issue of the uninsured because it is a surrogate for this concern about unemployment and underemployment. We have a number of problems here. What I've found is I've traveled around the country and talked to executives in manufacturing firms, and we find it now in the service industry as well, is they took on an enormous burden in health and pension benefits, long-term unfunded liabilities, and as their ability to raise prices with deflation in many industries went away, they had to cut their costs. They cut employment, in many cases increased productivity. Now as the economy gets better, there is no desire to add those jobs back in because it means adding those burdens. And in many cases, what they're doing now is they're moving people off onto part-time status so that they can get rid of, or contractor status, they can get rid of those burdens. So people are going uninsured, more and more of them. And as this issue emerges, if you see in the Republican Congress next year and with the White House and the President's State of the Union message on January 20th, a heavy push and emphasis on the uninsured, it will tell you that they're really concerned about this employment issue.
Norman Ornstein, Charlie Cook, Tom Mann. When we come back, more of your emails, questions, comments as we look ahead toward 2004. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show Reader's Review is made possible in part by the members of WAMU and the National Endowment for the Arts.
I've got a tattooed on.
And welcome back. We're here at National Geographic Live talking about the fact that today is my husband and my 44th wedding anniversary, and we are very, very pleased to have made it to that point. I have an email here from Pat in Greenbelt, Maryland. She says, as a very active Democrat, I have two questions. If Dean does not get the party's nomination, do you think his legions will be there in November of 2004 for the chosen nominee, Tom?
Well, Diane, one, I think that's very unlikely that he will not be the party's nomination.
You do,
I think
at this
Howard
point.
Dean is the odds-on favorite. He has won the year of the invisible primary. He's the one candidate that's connected with the sentiment of Democratic voters in a very difficult period of time, and he has the money advantage. He's garnering increasing number of endorsements, and he's shown a resiliency to overcome obstacles. Nonetheless, if something were to happen and he wouldn't become the nominee, what happens to his supporters? It depends who the nominee is. If that nominee is anti-Bush, anti-war in Iraq, authentic, tough-minded, blunt-spoken, I'm trying to think of who that nominee would
Ralph
be.
Nader.
They would come aboard, especially if Howard Dean, generously, as we would expect, endorsed the candidate. But right now, it's a little hard to see who that might be. I suppose it could be John Edwards. Maybe it could be Wesley Clark, since he is also a strong anti-war candidate. But it's hard to identify such a candidate.
Any thoughts about if the Democratic candidate is Howard Dean, who he might choose as a vice presidential?
Wesley Clark. I don't know how he picks anybody else. I mean, because he really would need someone with very, very, very strong national security credentials. And you look around the Democratic Party and say, who has just this automatic aura of strength? And I can't come up with another name that would have the same bang for the buck as Wes Clark.
Let me add, I'm not so sure about this. First of all, it's not clear that Wes Clark as a general would be an ideal vice president. Some of this will depend on how he does through the course of this campaign, and they have had some real clashes personally.
Gee, I thought you all were going to tell me all of everything that was going to happen and not sort of maybe here and maybe there. Yes, you did.
But I would suggest a couple of other people to keep in mind, remembering that oftentimes the candidate feels compelled to pick somebody else in the race who's done well so you can add that particular base. But if it's not, keep your eye on Bill Richardson, the governor of New Mexico, who is the chair of the convention with strong national security credentials, not only traveled around the world and negotiated for the United States with North Korea and in the Middle East, was ambassador to the United Nations, is Hispanic governor of New Mexico, cutting taxes, and as gifted a natural retail politician as I've seen. Also, keep your eye on the two senators from Florida. Bob Graham, who's still very popular there, even though he did not well in the presidential contest, and Bill Nelson, former astronaut on the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees. If you can get somebody who gives you a little bit of an edge in Florida, then you've got something as well. So there are other options, although Clark does give you something that the others can't, but there are other options.
A question here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you. My name is Cora. I'm from Washington, D.C. I wanted to shift a little bit towards Medicare reform, which is something that we haven't talked about this morning. It hasn't been talked about on your show. And medical reform has been heralded by Republicans as historic, but there are a lot of people out there who are critical of the legislation that did pass. And I was wondering if you could speak to, your guests could speak to, how this is going to play in the presidential as well as the congressional races, given the contention over the legislation and given the fact that it's traditionally been a Democratic issue. And also, there have been organizations such as the AARP that have really said, we're supporting this bill for now because it's somewhat of an improvement, but we will keep working. And I'm wondering if your guests could speak to the incentives to keep working on this right now, if there are incentives or whether it's just going to fade because there has been something passed.
Thank you for your question, Tom.
Diane, let me say you had a fascinating interview with Bill Novelli, the head of AARP, yesterday. I also noted that AARP has withdrawn from its planned sponsorship of forums with the Chamber of Commerce and the administration on Social Security reform, sensing some vulnerability within their ranks. Listen, I think one of the biggest struggles in this campaign will be over how to define the meaning of the Medicare prescription drug bill. The president and the Republicans clearly see this as an opportunity to deal with what has been a weakness and show their compassionate conservatism. Democrats believe that seniors are deeply suspicious of the particular benefit that many will end up having less coverage because of the drop in. It's a combination of things. It's the drop in coverage from former employers. CBO estimates 3 million will drop in spite of the subsidies. It's because Medigap insurance now covers more generously prescription drugs than will the new plan, and Americans will be forced to choose one or the other, and Medicaid recipients will lose as well. Then there's information out about subsidies to health insurers beginning before the benefit begins. Democrats have plenty of targets here to go after, and I think it's a massive struggle, and Democrats are going to try to tie this to the broader, their broader charge that this administration looks out for its friends in the corporate world.
But there's a backlash here. The question is when. This bill does not take effect in any significant measure until 2006. The one thing that happens before the 2004 election is these discount cards, which will be meaningless for most seniors, but for some significant group, poorer ones get a $600 subsidy. It'll have a little positive effect. In the next Congress, Democrats every day are going to introduce new provisions to allow drugs to come in from Canada, to add to the benefit, to fill that donut, to try and make the point that this will be a big problem. But until seniors get the benefit, it's going to be a really interesting question as to whether they decide that this is bad for them when it's still theoretical.
Question here in the studio. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Lloyd. I'm from Washington, D.C. I tutor graduate students who are conducting research for their theses, and I'm hearing a rumor, it's just begun to come to the surface, but I've heard it more than once, that if George Bush is elected in 2004, because the military's been stretched so thin, and a lot of the people in reserves are not going to re-up, that they might try to justify reinstituting the military draft, and especially since he doesn't have to run again. What do you think? Or have you heard the same rumor?
I haven't heard the rumor, but that'd be one way to get young people to vote again.
Yeah.
but the thing is, I mean, first of all, I think, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I think the National Guard, I think the reserves, I mean, they may be destroyed. You know, I think we're so overextended. I don't know how we could take out Grenada at this point. I think we're in a tough position. I mean, I don't think we're going to bring back the draft, and I can tell you that the uniformed services, they do not want the draft back. They think they've had a higher caliber of people since in the volunteer army than before. They don't want to go back, but in terms of us being overextended, you're absolutely right.
But it's going to cost a lot of money in terms of higher salaries, and a larger regular military force to deal with the challenges that we have, because you are going to see shrinkage in both the National Guard and the reserves, and that's occurring at the same time we have other new demands placed on our military budget for weapon systems and the whole domestic side of terrorism. And then, of course, we're approaching the retirement of the baby boomers, and we have $500 billion annual deficits as far as the eye can see. So enormous pressure is building. My guess is the Republicans would never push to reinstitute the draft because it would affect their long-term ambitions of becoming the majority party in the country. The Bush's ambitions go beyond his own time in office. He wants to build a broad, durable majority party, and this would nip it in the butt.
The only way this happens is if there's another significant war going on at the same time. Then it could happen. It's very unlikely. But all the things that Tom suggested would say that the 2006 elections could be a real watershed here, with all of the dissatisfaction culminating in a backlash.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And caller in Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Diane. Excellent show, of course, as always.
Thank you.
I have been constantly wondering why nobody has discussed two very impressive plays that Time Magazine did, more than a year ago. One issue dealt with Attorney General Janet Reno, who held a terror drill in D.C. involving 300 to 400 local police departments. It was patterned after an attack by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, bombing a major building in New York City and a major building in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. The second one was a Sandy Berger spread and a long interview. Of course, he was a national security advisor for Bill Clinton. And he made a great point over a three-day period of briefing the Bush national security team, saying that the combined threat of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda will occupy more of their time than everything else combined. Subsequently, Bush dismantled the 24/7 watch that the White House had mounted on Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda group.
Any comments, recognition of...
I'm not familiar with the first incident at all. The second, I mean, I do remember that Sandy Berger did tell the Bush folks that, you know, he stayed up nights, or I can't remember what the phrase was, but worrying about Osama bin Laden. So, you know, but you know, I think taking that warning and then extenuating out to use it for some kind of operational intelligence is another thing. One other point to the last point. The only way I could see the draft ever coming back would be within the confines of some broader compulsory national service that you could see, and where the military would be one of the options within some kind of a compulsory service, which actually might not be that bad of an idea.
Diane, let me just add, I think the report of the 9/11 Commission in May could well bring both of these matters back to the fore. The Sandy Berger briefing of Condoleezza Rice is something that's well known and has been discussed a lot in Washington and by some of the candidates. I think if, in fact, the Commission makes the charge that the government was inattentive, then the Berger briefing will loom large.
One final question for all of you. Hillary Clinton has been fairly conspicuous in the past few weeks. I wonder how prominent a role you see her playing in Democratic politics in 2004. Charlie Cook.
You know, Senator Clinton is obviously one of the very best known figures in the Democratic Party, high profile. You know, if she does anything at all, it gets an enormous amount of attention. But at the same time, anytime she does anything, goes anywhere, it immediately elicits a reaction among mainly conservatives and Republicans. Ah, she's going to get in. I mean, I know people, almost entirely Republicans, absolutely convinced she's going to get in the race. Now, I think a lot of these are people who, if she says the sun was going to come up in the morning, they'd look for it to come up in the evening because they just think she's incapable of telling the truth. The other thing, I think that they want to see her lose. But the thing is, I don't hear any Democrats who think she's going to get in. And the thing is, I think no matter what she does, it's going to generate news. But she's a high-profile person in the party. I don't think it's more or less than that.
And Charlie Cook gets the last word here this morning. You've had lots to say. I thank you so much for being here. Tom Mann of the Brookings Institution. Charlie Cook of the National Journal. He's also editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. And Tom Mann of the Brookings Institution. I'll be off for a voice treatment, and I'll be back with you after the holidays. I look forward to being with you on January 2nd. Have a good holiday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Elizabeth Terry, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, and Jonathan Smith. The engineer is Karen McManus. Dori Annisman has been on the phones. The program comes to you from American University in Washington. For schedule information and audio archives, visit our website at WAMU.org. You can order cassettes online at WAMU.org or at 202-885-1200. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.